Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is Mornings with Carmen. It is a Thursday, March the 7th. I don't know. Am I allowed to say Happy Lent? Like, I don't know. That seems like a strange connecting of two words. So Blessed Lent, maybe Holy Lent. If for those of you who are actively engaged in a Lenten discipline, I received a little text this morning from my friends over at the NALC, which is the North American Lutheran Church. They have a Lenten devotional that you can sign up for that, you know, they send you via your text message every morning. So that's a blessing to me. Maybe you have found a Lenten devotional practice that enriches your life and deepens your discipleship. If so, I'd love to know what that is. You can text me at 877-933-2484. Again, that number is 877-933-2484. You can always email me, Carmen at myfaithradio.com. I want to lead off this morning with a conversation about the process by that which things that were once anathematized, right? Things that we all clearly considered wrong. So how do those things which we all once considered wrong? Well, personalize this. Is there something that you once considered wrong that you now consider right? Something that you once considered unholy that you now consider righteous? Something that you once considered wrong. I don't have another word for that. Sin. And now you somehow consider it not sin. How did that process take place in your own mind, in your own heart? And how is that process taking place in the culture writ large? That's what I really want to emphasize this morning, because every single story that that has bubbled to the top, at least of my newsfeed, is about things that we have normalized as a culture, things that which we once anathematized. So here are my initial thoughts on this morning. So things which we once considered wrong have to be rationalized, first of all, is not wrong. We have to get to the place where we rationalize that which is bad as being good. And once we have rationalized it, we then popularize it. And once it's popularized, it is then very quickly decriminalized and formally legalized. And once something is legalized, it is actually normalized in the culture. So the process of something becoming normalized is often through it being legalized. And by the way, once something has been rationalized, popularized, decriminalized, and legalized, and normalized, anyone who continues to stand in opposition to it, who continues to anathematize it, is then marginalized. That's just how this works. So in different ways, through various agents, we see this process initiated and realized in pop culture, public education, higher ed, the church, the media, most powerfully through social media and social networks. Maybe you see it take place in the corporate world where you work. So I want you to consider this list for just a second. Homosexuality was rationalized from that which everybody understood to be bad as to something which some rationalized to be good. And homosexuality, once rationalized, was then popularized, then decriminalized, then formally legalized. You'll remember that happened in 2015 through the Obergefell decision of the United States Supreme Court. Efforts to normalize homosexuality are now virtually complete. I don't know how else to say that. But efforts today seem to now focus on the normalization of a wider variety of once anathematized sexual behaviors, couplings, throuplings, groupings. And we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about efforts to normalize transgenderism through all kinds of efforts. Okay, then let's look at like abortion and marijuana. Abortion, once anathematized, marijuana use, once anathematized. But abortion and marijuana have an added feature that's not true, I think, so much of the normalization in our culture of homosexuality and other sexual sins. Abortion and marijuana have the added feature on their route to legalization and normalization. They have been medicalized. So if you can medicalize abortion, if you can medicalize marijuana, I think you can more easily legalize and normalize them. And so as abortion was legalized now, you know, 4 decades ago, we now see efforts to normalize through legalization. So they're going to medicalize it, and then they're going to legalize it in an attempt to normalize it, and that would be infanticide. So what's next on the normalization through legislation front? That is what I am going to talk about this morning with Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. So if you want to know what's next on the normalization through legalization front, stick with us here on Mornings with Carmen.
This is my right, a right given by God, to live a free life.
Joining me now on Mornings with Carmen is Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. Ben is a senior editor there. He works, his work focuses on the principles necessary to create a free and virtuous society. And so, Ben, welcome back to Mornings with Carmen.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's talk about the legalization of prostitution. How did we arrive at the place where we have Kamala Harris calling for the decriminalization of sex work and insisting that any opposition to it is racist? How did we get to this place?
It's an unusual path, to say the least. Counterintuitive, I guess, would be the word. When it comes to this decriminalization of prostitution, this is something that's been in the pipeline for a very long time. There was actually a UN report that came out 7 years ago, which said that decriminalizing prostitution violates prostitution. The fact that prostitution is illegal violates prostitutes' human rights. So this is something that has been advocated from the very highest levels, literally of the very world, for a very long time. The idea behind it is that consenting adults should be able to do whatever they like as long as no one is harmed. That's exactly the line that Kamala Harris took when she said this. She's calling for decriminalization of what she calls sex work. We would call it prostitution, specifically on the lines that these are consenting adults and no one is being harmed in this process. There's a group in New York State called Decrim New York, which has enlisted the help of 3 state senators as well as an assemblyman, and they plan to introduce a bill to completely decriminalize all forms of sex work in the state. And that means not simply, this is a little bit more radical than just decriminalizing prostitution. This is the idea that there should be absolutely not only legal prostitution, but that anyone who's ever been convicted of prostitution would have that record expunged completely. The way that they got to the point that it's racist is through something called disparate impact, which you see at the Supreme Court all the time. If something has a disproportionate impact on a minority group, which is to say that more minorities are arrested than other groups, or that a larger percentage of minorities are arrested than there are total in the population, then it's racist ipso facto. The very fact that more are affected makes it racist, regardless of what happened to make that happen. So the group Decrim New York is led by transgender people. It's also led by Hispanics, and they are tying themselves by saying that since more minorities are arrested for prostitution, that prostitution is a way of targeting minorities and persecuting them. Of course, that's completely erroneous in every way, but regardless, this is a way of harming people, and more importantly, this doesn't actually help the people that it's intending to help.
Well, and I think that for me, you know, that is the larger point here for Christians to hone in on. Let me read the Kamala Harris quote for those who haven't heard it yet. Kamala Harris, who is a presidential candidate, made these statements in an interview on Tuesday. Kamala Harris said, "When you're talking about consenting adults," which is a point I would settle in on, "I think that, yes, we should really consider that we can't criminalize consensual behavior as long as no one is being harmed." She went on to say, But at the point that anyone is being harmed or exploited, then we have to understand that's a different matter. So, you know, Ben, I wasn't there. I didn't have a microphone. I'm not given the opportunity to confront her directly in the statements that she makes. But engaging in conversations with others today about this subject, I would hone in on what does consent actually mean? And are the people who are engaged in selling themselves for sex actually consenting? Like, are they not already somehow being victimized, harmed, and exploited simply by a culture that would see sex as commodified? So that would be one thing. And this idea that no one is harmed, I think really begs the question of what the definition of harm is. I see it as dehumanizing to the individuals involved. Sex is clearly it's not considered sacred. I don't know how to say that in a one word, desacralized. I don't know. And then it clearly harms marriage. It harms families. It harms communities. It harms people's ability to do their jobs. It promotes a culture of like hidden sin. It promotes a pornified culture. I mean, it feeds the beast of pornification. I mean, I the list of harms done to the individuals involved and to culture writ large seem to me obvious.
Yeah, the fact that someone is consenting is dubious in itself, but we would say that there are certain things that no one should be able to buy or sell regardless. You know, even if they are consenting in that form, there are certain things that are simply so sacred that they can't be bought or sold. They can only be given and received. And sex is something that God created to be given in a covenant relationship, and it comes with attendant responsibilities because sex leads to the creation of children. And outside of that covenant, then it hurts the children who are conceived. They may be aborted. They may be raised without one of those two parents and isolated from one of their biological parents, and that's not fair to the children. We know that that harms society in a variety of ways. Even Barack Obama, who was a victim of a marriage that broke up, he talked eloquently about how the fact that he was deprived of a father hurt himself. But then it also hurts those who are allegedly being held by the decriminalization. When you're talking about consent, there are a couple of different things to look at. First of all, in the UN report that I mentioned from 2012, acknowledges many of these people are doing this in order to pay for an addiction. And if someone is addicted, are they really consenting? That we would say no. If you pay for something, you sign a contract or something under the influence, then you are not fully informed about consent. Second of all, the average age that someone begins as a prostitute is the age of 12. So that's someone who is not capable of consent. And can you say that someone who has been molested, who has been trafficked and harmed from the age of 12, suddenly at the age of 18, becomes a fully informed, fully consenting adult and is capable of giving consent? We would say that that's a process that began way in advance, and her consent has been denied, perhaps his consent has been denied in every way, and so his agency has been denied. So that's not someone who is consenting. And then third of all, even if we're talking about people who are adults, many of the people who are involved are still trafficking victims. In the UK, there was a government agency which recently was talking about this, and they said that sex trafficking in the UK, where prostitution is legalized, is taking on an industrial scale. People from Eastern Europe, women from Eastern Europe, are brought in with the allure of false jobs. As soon as they get there, their passports are confiscated. They're immediately placed into brothels or forced to work in sex work. And from that point forward, they're presented as consenting, but in fact, they're prisoners. So there's a consent that is lacking, and the fact that it is formally consented to in some ways would be more harmful to our society than simply keeping the status quo as it is. Some things are meant to be illegal.
Mm. Absolutely. All right. Ben Johnson and I are going to continue talking about, well, things in the culture that are relevant to each and every one of us. We have talked now about efforts to legalize prostitution. I'd like to turn in our conversation next, Ben, and I know we need to take a quick break, but let's turn in our conversation next to The fact that the Washington Post has written an apology to a teenager from Covington, well, actually the whole group of teenagers from Covington, but it seems as if we've buried it. So that's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Ben, I understand that you are like an early saver, and that even though this weekend is daylight savings, like we're going to actually lose an hour, you went ahead and you banked that hour in advance by sleeping in this morning.
Well, I did, in fact. I was hoping that I was covering for it, but I woke up about 30 seconds before we started speaking this morning. Yes, that's right.
So we'll just consider that you're an early saver. I mean, you know, I think that that's a positive attribute, a person who is, you know, looking ahead and going ahead and putting away what they know they're going to lose later. So there you go. Ben, talk with us about this Washington Post apology to the Covington teenagers, which really then seemed to get buried.
Well, it did, and it sort of reminds you of the old the Mark Twain saying that a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth can lace its shoes up. That's really what happened here. Everyone knows that the Covington kid story went viral. Most of your listeners would know for a fact that what was presented to the media was almost 180 degrees different from reality. They were presented as though they were being the offenders. They were trying to harm this elderly Vietnam veteran and American Indian activist who was just trying to be calm and peaceful, and they were blocking his route. And you know, as it turned out, the exact opposite turned out to be the case. They were being targeted by a different group that wasn't shown in the video at all, the Black Hebrew Israelites, sort of an anti-white racist and oftentimes anti-Semitic cult group being targeted. And then this individual, Nathan Phillips, came over, and it looked as though he were stirring the pot rather than trying to calm the waters. And so that story went viral. The Washington Post did post a retraction after their lawyer came forward. Nathan Sandman Nick Sandman got a lawyer, and he made the first of many, many letters to the Washington Post, telling them that their coverage was completely wrong, potentially libelous, and that he could sue them for Jeff Bezos' entire initial investment in their paper if they didn't make a correction. So a correction was forthcoming. They understand he has a fantastic, robust case against them. And so they issued a retraction, but it's not something we've seen a lot. Your listeners know that it's not true, but remember, we're almost a hermetically sealed culture. It's essentially a case where in social sciences have shown this. I believe Pew Research was the most recent one that's done it. But fewer and fewer people know anyone who disagrees with them, and especially at the level of elite opinion maker. So some people fall into that category. You do, quite obviously, shaping the opinion of masses. But I'm kidding. You're one of the people. But when we're talking about Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post, they don't know anybody who disagrees with them. And so they're not exposed to these other viewpoints. And so when the Washington Post runs a retraction weeks and weeks later, that's the only thing that they see is this sort of strangely worded, very antiseptic sort of correction that says there was additional context that had to be added, and there was more that needed to be known. And so they've deleted a tweet about what they did. So this was a hit job from the very beginning. It was just too good for the media to actually wait for the facts to come in. They decided that this confirmed everything that they believed about people who live in between New York and San Francisco or New York and Hollywood. Everyone in the middle essentially falls into this category. And so it was just too simple to brand them all as racist and evil, anti-Native, ignorant, because they were supposedly chanting to keep a wall to keep American Native Americans out of their own country. It was just too good to let go. And now they should have to eat crow in front of everybody that they know. And the fact is that this lawsuit has produced a little bit of a step down. It should produce a robust college scholarship for everybody who was in this video.
Hmm. Ben, thank you so much for being with us today on Mornings with Carmen. I do think that the relationship between guilt and shame and our willingness to shame people in public, but then not sort of be held to account in public ourselves is at the crux of this. And I think that every single one of us in the conversations that we're having today We ought to pause. We ought to hit the pause button and ask ourselves, am I simply responding to this because I am prone to believe the very worst about the person involved, or the group involved, or the situation involved? And am I sure that I am a person who is passing along the truth and promoting the truth? Because certainly as Christians, that's what we want to be doing in the culture writ large. Folks, I got to take a quick break to lighten up. Ben Johnson, thanks for joining us again on Mornings with Carmen.
Thanks so much. God bless.
So we led off this hour by observing the process through which things which were once anathematized become normalized. In the case of abortion, the route taken was, hey, let's medicalize it, and then we could legalize it and normalize it, completely destigmatize it, and now there are those who want to glamorize it. Does that just break your heart? It breaks my heart that folks want to glamorize abortion. Kim Cotola from Cradle My Heart is up next to tell us how that is happening and what we can do about it. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBerge.
If you're in the midst of your darkest hours, listen carefully. This is Jim Garlow. God is always revealing himself, especially in those darkest moments. I speak from personal experience. My first wife, Carol, died on April the 21st, 2013. At the time, I didn't think I could ever function again. I wasn't sure the Lord would be able to heal me. I didn't know that eventually Rosemary would step into my life and bless me in ways I cannot describe. I didn't know that then. All I knew was that these were the darkest days. But God showed himself, both through the people he brought and most assuredly through the peace he infused into my heart by his word. Rest assured, in the midst of darkness, God is with you. He will never forsake you. He'll keep showing himself until you're caught up in heaven and see him physically. Get well-versed at jimgarlow.com.
Kim Cotola joins us now from Cradle My Heart to talk about not only this process through which here in America, abortion has been not only decriminalized or legalized, but also medicalized, destigmatized, normalized, and now an attempt for abortion to be glamorized. Kim, welcome to Mornings with Carmen. What's going on here?
Carmen, good morning. You're one of the few people that I could talk with this about and not just become enraged, because we have, you know, we have the truth, right? So, I mean, the women who put together the Shout Your Abortion back in 2015 have now got a book, and they've had a speaking tour for a while. Amanda Bono and a few others are shouting your abortion, and now to the point, Amelia Bono is her name, and now to the point where they have created a line of swag. So it's abortion t-shirts and abortion ball gowns with the word abortion displayed prominently on the clothing. And they said that it's a direct attempt to glamorize abortion, because that's the one word. I mean, it was one thing to normalize it, as the Democratic National Committee did in 2012 when they took the word rare out of their platform as a party. That we're going to normalize it. It shouldn't be rare. If there's nothing wrong with it, why should it be rare, right? So now, but now these women are taking Shout Your Abortion beyond. Lindy West is the other co-founder of Shout Your Abortion. They turned it into a 501c3. And so with these, you know, clothing and other swag, they're trying to glamorize it, right? Because we shouldn't be afraid of glamorizing it. We should go ahead and say it was a net positive. It was a good thing in my life. It was, you know, it made my life possible, and all these rhetorical talking points and rationalizations that these women have adopted. So yeah, tattoos, graffiti, put abortion everywhere because it's such a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it's owning your own life on your own terms, as Bono told realchangenews.org. And, you know, I mean, I understand why women would want to do that. I understand the rationalization. I mean, I engaged in that for 23 years myself.
I think that's right. That's fair to say, right? If I can get to the place where I can convince you to celebrate with me that which I have done, even if at the starting point, you and I both know that what I have done is wrong. But if I have rationalized it and I demand that you not only rationalize it, but because it's legalized in the culture, it's normalized. And then I can convince you to celebrate it with me through what we're going to call, you know, glamorizing it. Then I have very successfully created a way that I can actually live peaceably with my sin. And that's really troubling to me, because once we have arrived at that point, then the, you know, frankly, the power of regret, the power of recognizing what we have done, is totally like frosted over, with, you know, sort of the icing of our generation. Like, right, we're just going to make it sweet. We're going to make it, we're going to act like it tastes good. And yet it's not ultimately going to benefit anybody.
What a powerful statement, Carmen. That's it. Exactly. I mean, I've often said abortion either, you know, breaks our hearts or it hardens our hearts. And when those videos came out that showed exactly what happens to the remains of our children in an abortion, those of us who had experienced abortion, who had, you know, hearts broken already, were devastated by those reports. It became very personal. Was my, you know, baby treated, we know our babies were treated as medical waste, but were they then harvested and, you know, things done against our will to our children? I mean, it was just a devastating time in 2015. Whereas those who had hard hearts looked at that evidence, Carmen, looked at those children and said, that wasn't a bad thing. That was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. How dare you try to stigmatize me? And so we see this, you know, shamelessness. And as you say, I mean, our regret, our shame, our grief is our hope, because that's what's going to lead us to reconciliation with God, with ourselves, and with the entire experience, with our children. You know, I mean, to deny all of that, to deny that there is a standard that we violated, to deny that there were children that we lost, all of these things, in order to say, I'm a great person and abortion made my life possible. You're right. I mean, this is the point at which the word says God gives us over, right, to that depraved mind. And I think we're seeing it writ large with this now, this new attempt to glamorize it.
So, Kim, neither you nor I are trying to make a listener who right now is a person who has engaged in an abortion, who's had an abortion. Neither one of us are attempting to stigmatize that individual nor hurt them. But we are hoping that they will see abortion for what it is and then turn and confess that and actually get the real healing and reconciliation that is possible. Maybe let's approach this way. Where is your baby now? And what is your hope for the future of your relationship with that child?
Thank you for this opportunity, too, because you're right. I mean, in speaking the truth, we cannot condemn those. I mean, how could I, Carmen? I was there. I'm guilty as charged. And I have no excuse before our holy and righteous Lord. However, the blood of Jesus Christ has paid for that, as well as every other sin and every other abortion that anyone has, you know, ever committed for any reason, whether coerced, whether wanton. It, you know, his sacrifice is sufficient for us, and our faith is what activates that sacrifice in our lives to make it real and viable. And, you know, when that gift of repentance was given to me, I can recall a distinct moment, Carmen, when I crossed over the line and said, guilty as charged. I was repentant. I returned to the truth that I had done something heinous. And a wonderful thing occurred for me, which is the answer to your question, where is the child now? I gained this assurance that the Lord received that child. You know, the word says, Jesus said, let the little children come to me. And he said, it's not my Father's will that any of these should perish. Having created that life, why would he not provide for them eternally, right? And I gained the supernatural knowledge that the child is safe with the Lord in heaven. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I believe this is so because of his mercy. I believe it's affirmed in Scripture because we know the character of God, you know, and that destroying life is the work of the enemy of our souls. You know, God is the author of life. And so, you know, what we must do is find our way to the Lord, find our way to faith in what he has done for us and for our children, and look forward with hope to a heavenly reunion. There's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And abortion is not that special sin. But the thing that it is, Carmen, is it's a layer of grief on top of the guilt of the sin. And if you buy into our culture's lie that this is not a human being, you have no place to put that grief. What am I grieving? It wasn't a person, right? And so it can become this sort of complicated, drawn-out process of trying to, you know, believe that you are forgiven when you're still not willing to let go of having been a mother to that child. That's the other lie of it. I wasn't ready to be a mother, Amelia Bono. I wasn't forced into motherhood was the rhetoric that she used, you know, in her piece. And it's pregnancy that makes us mothers, not childbirth. We call them expectant mothers when women have not yet given birth. We are mothers already. The presence of a child in the womb makes us a mother to that child. And so, you know, we need to grieve that lost motherhood. We need to grieve that lost child. And, you know, yes, maybe abortion opened up some opportunities to you that motherhood might have temporarily shut down. But the grief is what is, I think she's defending against. And she's trying to project that onto others by calling it stigma. And I'm glad that you rightly point out that, you know, God cares about our tears and provides for us in our grief. And also, of course, as I said, you know, it provides for removing that guilt from us so that we can be with him eternally. But to project it out onto others and saying, you're trying to stigmatize me, is simply to once more deny what actually happened in the abortion, that loss of a child, and your volition to destroy that life as the mother.
Mm. So, Kim, it occurs to me that even as you say that the presence of a baby, of a child, makes a woman a mother, it also, that presence of that baby, makes a man a father. And we have a recent precedent for fathers of preborn children out of Alabama. So let's talk about that in just a moment. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm continuing my conversation with Kim Cottola from Cradle My Heart. This is Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. I am talking with Kim Cottola from Cradle My Heart. Kim, I have read this headline out of Alabama that an Alabama probate court is allowing a man who happens to be the father of the child in question to sue on behalf of an aborted fetus, on behalf of his child. And that that child is known in these court documents as Baby Roe. And so part of this conversation is about personhood. It's about the action of the Alabama legislature to actually have a state policy ensuring the protection of the rights of unborn children, recognizing, supporting the sanctity of unborn life, the rights of unborn children, including the right to life. And it's really on the heels of that, the acknowledgement of fetal personhood, that this case comes. And so we think it's the first one in the country that's anything like this. Obviously, pro-abortion activists are not in favor of this kind of rights of the dad. Give us your perspective on this story.
Well, what it does is put into stark contrast the idea that abortion is reproductive freedom or reproductive justice for women. That's nonsense. Women secured the right to abort their children at the expense of the rights of men and of the children. And so how can that be equal rights, Carmen? I mean, on Tuesday, Madison County Probate Judge Frank Barger granted this young man's petition to represent the estate of his unborn child in a decision that his attorney said breaks new legal ground. And it's just this. I mean, with Roe v. Wade, there's, you know, at least some acknowledgement of the tension that exists between the rights of an unborn child and the rights of a woman as a pregnant woman. You know, and the courts decided that until that child can live independent of the mother, her rights trump any rights that that baby would have. Well, these personhood amendments in Alabama and other states seek to go back and say, you know, viability is an arbitrary moment. I mean, if we have equal human rights by virtue of our shared human nature, that means we have them from conception forward. When embryology teaches us, we become human at our conception. And so if we are persons, then we should attain to our rights and find some other way to resolve the competing rights claims between a baby and a woman who doesn't wish to be carrying that baby, right? And so, you know, in that discussion, the rights of the fathers have been completely eradicated. And this young man is seeking to redress that. Now, you know, a lot of the legal experts in the case have said there's no way. Married men, this couple wasn't married, married men have sued to try to assert the rights of fathers in the lives of their children before they're born, and the courts have struck them down. Lucinda Finley is a professor at University of Buffalo School of Law that Daily Beast consulted for an opinion. And she said, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has already struck down laws requiring women to obtain permission from their partners for abortions and, you know, when they're married. And so this lawsuit, she says, isn't going to change that because U.S. constitutional law already says it's her decision, not his. But we'll see. We'll see what happens in Alabama. You know, it's not just that he, as she put it, fervently wishes that his girlfriend had accepted his plea not to have an abortion. The question is here, does he have any right to assert his position as father of that child? It's not just about her wishes. They've tried to make everything about her wishes, even with these new laws about, you know, what happens if a child survives an abortion. Well, if she doesn't want it to live, then it doesn't live, even though it's a healthy infant in some cases. Right. And so I'm glad that he's undertaken this action, and I'm really curious to see how it's going to unfold based on amendment to the personhood of Alabama amendment.
So it occurs to me, Kim, that one of the conversations that, you know, probably needs to be had afresh today, everybody out there who has got a son, who has a son, who is a teenager, who is a young adult, high school, college, out of college, but not married. This is a conversation you absolutely have to have today, because what we are seeing here is the reasonable or logical consequence of having sex outside of God's chosen covenant, which is marriage between one man and one woman, where sex is intended then to produce babies, and those then produce families, and those families are the building blocks of society and our social order. So the conversation to be had today, it needs to be about purity. It needs to be about sexual purity. It needs to be about the sacredness of the marriage bed. It needs to be a pro-marriage conversation. And all of that needs for Christians to be based on God's really good design for sex. Sex is not a bad thing. It's just only to be had in a particular context, because God knows what's produced through sex are babies. And God wants babies. And in order for, you know, us to actually fulfill the mandate to multiply, this is actually, friends, this is just how it works.
Well, and I agree. And to speak with our sons about their God-given role as a procreator and as protector, you know, and that with these rights come responsibilities, you know. And so it's interesting, the natural rights, I should say. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important for us to help our sons understand that our sons and our brothers and our husbands and men, that you know, the way that we have structured our culture, they have no legal standing in the lives of their unborn children. And yet the government will turn around and coerce them to pay through adulthood if they don't wish to become fathers. You know, I think if more men really understood that they have been, they're really second-class citizens when it comes to reproduction, that they would be, I think, a lot more cautious about, you know, as you said, not doing sex God's way. And not only that, but I think that, you know, they would, abortion liberates men from their responsibilities as fathers. You know, Lifeway did research that showed the most influential person on a woman's decision to have an abortion is her partner. And, you know, in 2/3 of the cases, men are pushing for the abortion because, you know, they didn't take that action seriously when they decided to become sexually active. In many cases, sometimes, you know, women are already mothers. We can't generalize. It's not always just, you know, unprotected sex with unmarried couples that's driving the abortion, you know, epidemic in America today.
Sure. I mean, there are plenty of married women who are having abortions. And so, yeah, I'm using this case as illustrative.
Right.
And hoping that there are, you know, folks listening right now who are saying, you know what, I really do need to revisit that subject matter with the young men in my family or the young
so
men in my
can,
life.
Right. So that they can do and know what their position actually is and what their responsibilities actually are and what joy awaits them for doing it God's way.
That's exactly right. Kim Cotola, thank you so much for joining us today on Mornings with Carmen. All right. Whew. We've undertaken a lot in this first hour of the program today. And we're talking about how things are normalized through legalization. And we're going to continue those kinds of conversations in the next hour, moving to the normalization of transgenderism in a conversation with Dr. Peter Kapsner. So that's up in the next hour here on Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You can always visit us online at myfaithradio.com. Grab today's podcast and share it with somebody else. I know that Kim's conversation is a blessing to us all. I'll be back with another hour in just a minute. Good morning. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You know, there are some days when the headline news is filled with all kinds of things that, frankly, those of us living in local communities don't really have a particular connection to. But the writ large headline news yesterday, and therefore probably that which will be screaming at you today, is going to be related to Michael Cohen and his testimony before Congress. Well, but not before all of Congress, but before a committee of Congress, an oversight committee, yesterday on Capitol Hill. And so let me encourage you, when you are engaged in those conversations, and when people are described as con artists and liars and racists, like, those are good opportunities for you as a Christian to jump into the conversation and say, let's talk about those words. Let's talk about the depravity of the human heart. Let's talk about the reality of sin being pervasive. And we're not excusing any behavior. None of us know enough about what really happened to actually, like, honestly probably come down on either side of who's telling the truth in this. If you're looking for talking points related to the Michael Cohen testimony yesterday, one of those would simply be the concept of testimony. Who gives testimony? What is a witness? What is my testimony? And of whom am I bearing witness today in the reality of the world? When I live as a person of truth, who is a follower of Jesus Christ, who is the way and the truth and the life, when I am a person of truth, am I speaking in every circumstance the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? And am I doing so in reliance upon God? So those are just some ways to jump into the Michael Cohen conversation today without actually going down into the sleazy dirt that is being stirred up in that particular conversation in Washington. All right, friends, you are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I am Carmen LaBerge. Thanks for taking me along wherever you are going today. We got another hour up ahead, and we'll be right back. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBerge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.